this week on the Inside Flap.
When you go to like a writing conference, do like all the pantsers hang out in one corner of the room and the outliners in the other? Or
yeah, we want to play dodgeball. I've been trying to organize that, but nobody's up for it.
You got to get that going.
Oh, I'd pay to see that. That would be so good. That's really funny.
Well, you know, and we're writers. We're all nerds. You know, we throw it and go backwards.
That's true.
I'd hit myself. It'd bounce off again.
It would bounce off something.
Eliminate myself.
So as I continue to move my body, about a second and a half later, I hear this.
Oh, no.
And I turn around. Now, Andrew, do you remember the grandfather clock that was part of the production? Yes.
You are kidding.
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado. This is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Seated across the room to my right is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
And on the couch to my left is Andrew Dowd.
Excelsior.
No bulldog in the house as we're getting ready to travel to Arizona. So shout out to Tom and Cindy for watching the dogs for us. We're going to get an early start and head down to Arizona. Welcome to the show. Episode 190. We got a great guest for you today. We're joined once again by just one of our favorite authors, number one internationally best-selling author, Jeffrey Deaver is back on the show.
Ooh.
And that's right. Yes, let's give him a little applause. Always a lot of fun to talk to. Listen, here's a guy who's world-renowned. The guy has written over 40 books, and still you will not, I dare you to find a nicer guy on the face of this earth. In fact, I was in the Tattered Cover bookstore one day this past year, and there was a Jeffrey Deaver book there, and there was a clerk there. So anytime I can bring up the podcast, I do. I was like, oh, we just talked to this guy. He said, he came in here to talk. And the guy was like, nicest guy, just the nicest guy.
You know, he also, I think he said he was 72. Mm-hmm. 72 is the new 62.
You wouldn't know it. Yeah,
he looked 10 years younger.
Absolutely. Spry. Yeah. Just spry.
Don't use the word spry. Spry is used for elderly.
Spry. That's anyway, the point is he's got a new Colter Shaw book out now. It's called Hunting Time. Great. I love this book. And we'll have that conversation for you in just a second. But first, got a few last notes on our play, Red Ink, that we closed up. Number one, now I'm not sure who it was who put this guy
Dave Medicus
in charge of building the set. Mm. Because this guy, now, listen, the set ended up looking fabulous. However, if you've listened to the show over the years, you'll know that I'm a little bit accident prone. And it's not something you want to have when you've got, you know, a group of students around you and you've got power tools involved. And I'll give you two examples. Number one is I was in the black box, which is also just a great place to cut wood in. You want to get a small enclosed area with paint fumes and sawdust and everything else spraying around in this room. It's really just the greatest place to do work in.
Now, if you don't know this, sawdust is one of the most flammable things out there.
Oh, really?
So Dave, okay. I don't know where this is going.
You should say that. Let me tell you what happened. So I got Carly there. Now, you've heard me talk about Carly. She's the head of the set department, and she's holding down a piece. I think we're cutting like a 1x10. I think I was cutting it to size that we were building these bookcases. You know, you saw the bookcases in the show. So I'm cutting it with a circular saw, and it's going just fine. I'm wearing my glasses as the kids scream at me all the time, "Wear your safety glasses!"
Thank you.
So yeah. I have my safety glasses on as, you know, we did have a student rush to the ER. I don't know why I laugh when I say that. The year prior, as we were working on Midsummer, and you know, she got a splinter in her eyeball.
You are kidding me.
I didn't tell you
about
that.
Was she not wearing her safety glasses?
She was not. But she had glasses on.
Oh, but they don't wrap around. No. Oh.
So anyway, so I'm cutting it. I'm wearing my safety glasses. And then as I finish, I do a little flourish with the circular, not a flourish, but I kind of swing.
This is a nightmare. Andrew and I are
circular
shaking our heads.
Saw up in the air. For some, I don't know why. It's just like one of those things. You cut the wood, you feel good.
You're a drama teacher. You're
swinging
that's
up.
Why.
I am a drama teacher, first and foremost. Now, as I swing it, and I don't know how this happened, but somehow the cord came up and hit the blade as the blade was still rotating. Because the only thing I know is not sparks. I saw like a fist-sized fireball.
Whoa.
It come up in the middle of the air. Just whoosh, it came, and then there was a sound, whoosh, and then it disappeared, just like that. And I'm like, holy shit. And I look down, and I see the cord, which is now dangling from the circular saw, as it's been cut in half. And Carly, who had been looking down and holding the board, she looks up. She looks at me, and she goes, Did you hear something?
Oh, she
and I go,
it.
I go, nope. And I turn around and I grab the board and I walked away because I was not about to admit that I cut through my power cord on my circular saw.
You cut through cords all the time, though.
I do. I told the story with the hedge clippers. Yeah. I cut through an electrical cord all the time. It happens. I don't know why it happens so often.
Is this the first fireball we've seen?
This was my first fireball related incident at this school. I think I've told the story about at the Pier 1 Marina by the Bay Bridge.
I'm aware of that one.
And the massive 6-foot-tall fireball that occurred as I was guiding Ty Denny, who was driving the travel lift, and he banged into the, as we were hauling a boat out of the water, he hit the power line and knocked out all the power to the Bay Bridge.
Well, they knocked out power to like all of Kent Island.
Yes. Yes, have,
you know, 100,000 people without power.
Yeah, and I think that was about the fine that was imposed on the marina as well.
Oh,
yeah, they don't mess around. Don't mess around. All right, so there was that. Now, the second one involves just me, thankfully. It was just me. This was in crunch time. So it was our last Saturday build. And I got there extra early in the morning. It was like 7:30 in the morning. And I got there just because we had just so much to do. And oftentimes when the kids get there, I can't do as much work as I want to because half the time what I'm hearing is, Dave, hey, Dave, Dave, can you come over here a second? Dave, do you think we should, Dave, do you think, and it's just nonstop with the kids needing, especially when you got 6 different departments with costumes and lights and sound and everything else, and you're pulled in all these different directions. So I get there early. It gives me a chance to get a little work done before everybody gets in there. So 7:30 in the morning, I'm down there, and you know, the two pillars in the middle of the black box, these two square pillars, and we had to wrap those in plywood to create the whole look. Can't just leave them as black. And I'm down on the ground, and I'm putting in some baseboard on these pillars, right? So I'm on all fours, and I'm hammering in the, but I can't really get, not only is it hard to get a good position because it's down on the ground, but also all the furniture, because they've been using the space to rehearse in, so all the furniture for the play, plus all the chairs for the audience, is all in there. And they've been tucked away to the side, and this happens to be right where I am. And I didn't take the time, because it's 7:30, and I got a lot to do. I didn't take the time to move the stuff out of my way. I just kind of like scrunched into this little corner, and I'm attacking this baseboard. But I can't get the leverage, so I go to shift my position. And as I go to shift my position, I feel my backside hit something pretty solid. And I don't know, I don't take any notice of it because it feels like I think I've just smacked into the desk that's on the set there. So as I continue to move my body, about a second and a half later, I hear this.
Oh, no.
And I turn around. Now, Andrew, do you remember the grandfather clock that was part of the production? Yes.
You are kidding.
The grandfather clock that I had just gone out, driven an hour out of my way, and picked up for $100 off of Facebook Marketplace. Well, yes, I turn around and I look. It is face down and it is surrounded by probably 1,500 tiny shards of glass.
Not safety glass.
No. Not safety glass. Shattered. Much in the way the budget for this show was shattered.
True.
Everywhere across the black box. And I just, I literally just wanted to put my head down and cry. Everybody was so excited to see this. It was an integral part for the plot and for me to have found this grandfather clock. I was so excited. And here it is in ruins. I just wanted to cry.
Did you replace the glass?
Well, what I did, yes. Well, I picked it up and I noticed. Yes, the glass was gone from the door, and right. The door was now off its hinges, aww. But miraculously... The clock face glass was fine.
That was also off
the hinges. The molding around was broken, but we were able to super glue that. I went to Home Depot, got some plexiglass.
Oh, that's a good
idea. And we were able to cut the plexiglass to fit in actual grandfather clock.
You know, it probably would have been a good idea to replace the actual glass in that thing anyway, right? I mean, so maybe, you know, the
true,
reason...
That's true. You don't want to have glass on set like that anyway. Because someone's going to break it. And if knowing anybody, that someone is going to be the guy with the two thumbs. The problem was, I didn't want to admit, like, because I was the only one there. So I quickly swept up all the glass. I put it in my classroom. And then I didn't want to admit that I had just broken this until some snooping kid, as they were snooping around in my room, saw that it was broken. And I admitted that yes, indeed, I did break it. Of course, I also want to, I'm curious, and maybe we can ask Laura, your dad, about this, why Tom Lee, directly after the show was over, was up and had pulled the grandfather clock away from the wall and was looking at the serial number.
I grew up with a grandfather clock.
Yes.
And it looked exactly like that grandfather clock. Yeah. And he thought, oh, well, maybe you have this grandfather clock. Maybe this is my old grandfather clock.
Huh.
Yeah. I grew up with the bong, 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 bong.
Right,
yeah. But once you hear that, but you know, in your house, you just don't even hear it anymore.
No, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. And now the kids were like, why can't we get the grandfather clock to go off during the play?
I know. Tell you, though, there is something interesting to lay awake as a kid, and you listen to hear, and then you count. Like, is it 11 o'clock or is it midnight? And you count because you're awake. Yeah.
My grandfather, my Helen Mom's house, they had the ticking of the clock.
Oh. You know, I had a client who had a cuckoo clock. I think that would have driven me nuts.
I would love to have a cuckoo clock.
Driven
you cuckoo.
Yeah. You want a cuckoo clock, Dave?
Sorry. I would love to have one. Yeah,
really?
It'd be a lot of fun. Huh.
So here's the question. Why is the grandfather clock called a grandfather clock?
I have no idea, Andrew.
So,
this is a great question. Andrew, do you know why? I don't know. Why is a grandfather clock called a grandfather clock?
Well, as the master of useless trivia,
that's you.
In fact, I do have an answer.
Oh, okay.
So basically it was adopted.
That's right.
It was adopted back in 1876 because of a song called Grandfather's Clock, written by Henry Claywork, became popular.
Huh.
And thus it became known as the Grandfather Clock based on that song.
So just a popular song.
Just a popular song, yeah.
Like that Grandmother's Big Brass Bed or something. Isn't there that song? John Denver's song?
That's a Grandma's Feather Bed.
Grandma's feather bed.
Nothing to do with
brass bed. I always pictured it being brass.
So just think
Bob Dylan, who likes to lay on a big brass bed.
It could have just as easily been named Grandmother's Clock if the song had gone a different direction. But there you go.
All right, there you go. You just happen to know that it was an 18. Interesting that he would just happen to know it was in 1876.
Andrew's a smarty pants.
Interesting. Anyway, so that's what's going on in my world. Laura, you've been a little under the weather, a little sick.
I have been sick, and I thought I was getting better, and then I just haven't been. So I've been reading back-to-back cozies. So,
listeners, take note.
Get ready. You'll have some fun. Mm-hmm. But it's not on this show, but soon you'll hear my back-to-back cozies. Yeah. But I have a particular flavor of cozy that I've been enjoying, which is the English newcomer moves to the English countryside cozy.
Hmm.
And all of a sudden there's murders in this small English town.
Like fish out of water, Americans?
Yeah, a little bit. No, they're like from London.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've been enjoying that style of cozy an awful lot.
Nice.
But I'm also like, I'm not usually this time right now, but I'm ramped up for the holidays. I feel like I can't wait to start decorating. I'm ready to decorate the house. I'm ready to start making some cookies.
Yeah.
I usually don't.
In the spirit.
I don't ever want to listen to Christmas music before Thanksgiving. I almost feel like breaking my rule this year. I'm in the spirit. Yeah. And oh, I would say too, Thanksgiving's probably one of my least favorite holidays because I'm not a big, I don't like to cook that much. It's a lot of work. A
lot of work.
And
a lot of time in the kitchen.
I'm not like, oh, I must have turkey. Oh, I love pumpkin pie. I don't really like any of those things that much. They're okay. Mm-hmm. So I could do without the Thanksgiving. But this year, I'm like, I'm excited about it. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Good.
What do you guys like? Do you guys have a favorite Thanksgiving treat? I don't think I like stuffing, which I know is kind of boring.
No, I love stuffing and gravy too. I mean, I actually do like the cranberry.
I like the cranberry.
And apparently, it's very hard to find the cranberry sauce this year. Oh. There's a shortage.
You don't make it with the homemade?
I don't think we typically do.
Do you do that weird can thing?
Uh-huh.
Ooh.
Yeah.
What?
No, I can't eat that.
No,
I can't eat that.
Have that.
I mean, everything else is homemade, but I may be the only one that actually eats the cranberries. So,
oh, yeah. So they're not going to. The real cranberry is very, very good. I do like that.
I do enjoy the mashed potatoes and gravy. I'm all about the mashed potatoes and gravy.
Yeah, Dave does like that.
The Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, not so much. Not so much.
No. It is a spectacle, though, because it's live TV. And there's something about...
Well, you always hope that there's high winds and bad weather.
That's true.
And you hope to see one of those spooky people go into the MetLife building.
Yeah.
That's what you want.
You
want to
see them struggle. You want to see people dangling off the ground.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
So the show must go on.
Yeah. Yes. There's something about... Because I always like the Anderson Cooper when he's live in Times Square for the countdown.
Right.
Live TV in that you just don't know. And people mess up and... Mm. Yeah. But I feel like the Macy's one, they don't mess up.
Well, it's just the banter, because it's all pre-scripted, so it's
bad.
All written. Oh, this balloon took 75 people to wrangle it down, weighs 700 pounds, and
stands
36 stories tall. Look out, it's a bird, it's playing. No, that's the worst.
That's true.
Scripted.
I forgot. That's why it's not good. You're right.
Well, you know, what would be funny is to do a Thanksgiving parade broadcast, but to have Dave... dub his own personal play-by-play.
Yeah.
I don't think it would be radio friendly.
I'm telling you, it wouldn't be. But I have a feeling that might go viral.
Mm, all right. We'll work on that.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Sounds great.
That's a real good one. So yeah, I've been sick. I'm hankering for some Christmas spirit. I feel excited about it. And I'm also ready to be well again.
Yep.
Yeah. Andrew, how have you been?
So we had to pull the plug on we're going to go to Arizona for some warm weather.
Okay.
Speaking of plugs.
I'm just saying I'm sick and you're talking about pulling the plug over here.
Yeah, and so, but our little girl is sick.
Yeah.
And she had pneumonia two months ago.
I do have sound effect of Andrew pulling the plug.
Yeah. That happened yesterday too, but that's a different story. So she's sick. So basically it's like, well, we can't fly with her and so basically you decided, well, we're just not going to go on the trip.
You can drive. We're driving to Arizona.
Are you? You guys are driving?
No,
yeah,
we're driving. Yeah.
We're not. I mean, we
wouldn't. They have three kids and two dogs.
Well, and the dogs wouldn't go with us, but we're not. I mean, you know,
with a sick kid,
we'd lose 2 days like there and back.
Yeah.
And you guys are leaving a day earlier than we would have been.
Mm.
And you know, so it wasn't worth it, right? With her being sick, and we also because she had pneumonia.
Yeah.
And we still don't really know what's wrong with her.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not worth it. So it's just part of it. And there's just an abnormal bundle of people with like RSV and all kinds of stuff. So now I have a Ticketmaster story for you.
Okay.
So we basically got an invite where we can enter this lottery to see if we would be fortunate enough to buy Garth Brooks tickets.
Okay.
Garth Brooks.
Brooks.
Yeah, in Las Vegas.
As bad as me with King Super.
So,
are you a big Garth Brooks fan?
I've been to a concert. I mean, it's a fun concert, right?
Okay.
But we had like these nosebleed seats. Like, I mean, honestly, like probably the worst damn seats in the world. But but at least like back then, like when you bought your tickets at this particular place, all the tickets were the same price.
Oh, wow.
It's just a lottery in terms of which seat you get.
Oh.
Right? That's the way it used to be.
Huh.
Not the case in Vegas, at least. So we got in the lottery, and Katie and I both got the chance to buy tickets. Well, Katie's basically at the dentist's office with Peter getting teeth extracted. Mm. And she couldn't get the app or what the Ticketmaster app or whatever to work in the doctor's office.
Wait, hold on a second. Who's getting teeth extracted?
Well, so Peter has a problem that his baby teeth are not coming out the way they're supposed to.
Oh, poor Peter.
And so then the adult teeth couldn't come in. So he had to basically have three teeth extracted.
Wow.
That were really stuck in there.
Ouch.
So it didn't work out for her. And then I'm looking to buy tickets. But of course, I have a meeting scheduled, an important business meeting scheduled.
Yep.
At the same time as this kicks off.
Always the way it goes.
Now, I'm sitting there. I'm ready for both. I've got two computers.
Yeah.
I've got Ticketmaster on the right. I've got this important video conference call. where I basically have to have this meeting. And so I'm hoping, well, maybe this guy will show up late. And so I've got everything ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, we're in this meeting, and it's a meeting where I have to pay attention. It's not like some conference call where there's 50 people on it.
It's a one-on-one.
Yeah, it's a one-on-one. And so I'm listening, and, and so basically I put four seats in the basket, and I click on it to go check out, and it says, oops, somebody else has already taken those teeth. And I'm just like,
I had a client have that for Taylor Swift. She said she did it 100 times.
Yeah. And so I did that.
Oh, four seats. So you were going to go ahead and buy tickets for Laura and myself, apparently.
That's right. It's going to be a trip. So anyways, and this would have been like a May 20th, May 21st, but of next year.
We're busy.
So basically, after that happened, I'm like, well, I really need to pay attention to this call. And so I abandon it.
Yeah.
And then by the time the meeting was over and I went back, right? There's like only 20 seats left and none of them are together.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like, I hope Katie got tickets, but Katie didn't get tickets either. But but unfortunately...
let's play a little trivia game.
That was my experience with Ticketmaster.
Name three Garth Brooks songs.
Achy Breaky Heart. I can't name any Garth Brooks
songs. I can't name any Garth Brooks songs either.
But I'm not out buying tickets for him.
Well, but if you started singing a Garth Brooks song, I probably would know. I probably recognize his most popular
that's
songs.
Funny.
But it's
Friends in Low Places. I think that's Garth Brooks.
That's not Garth Brooks, is it?
I think it is. I think it is.
I know that one. I didn't know I knew any of his songs.
So that's my but the thing with the Ticketmaster is like when that window happens. And who knows?
It's so stressful.
Like, I think I probably would have gotten tickets if I could have focused on it,
mm-hmm.
but I couldn't control the time.
You might not have, Andrew. So I talked to a client today, and I know her daughter's a huge Taylor Swift fan. So I said, hey, did you get tickets? She said, no. She said, I never got the little code to get into the presale. She said, however, we have a Capital One credit card, and Capital One's hosting her when she comes out. And so the next day, Capital One had their own presale if you have a Capital One card. So she gets in using her Capital One Visa card and goes to buy tickets. Oh, sorry. Another person has grabbed those. Does it again. She said she did it probably 100 times.
Whoa. What?
And then at the end, it was like 4:30 in the afternoon. And they're like, hey, we're sold out. And it just happened over and over and over again.
Disaster.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, I'll tell you what is not a disaster, and that is Jeffrey Deaver. What a great guest we've got for you today. Joined by, and in fact, I think that was when you were trying to buy the Taylor Swift ticket,
right?
And we had Jeffrey Deaver.
We did.
You weren't able to get
well,
on.
Well, I never even got the code.
Well, you didn't get in there anyway.
I'd been waitlisted.
It didn't matter. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So he's back on the show. Always a lot of fun to talk to. He's got a new Coulter Shaw book out now. It is called Hunting Time. And listen, let me tell you a little bit. Well, actually, I won't tell you a little bit about this book because Jeffrey Deaver does a great job of telling you all about it in our interview.
He does.
So you'll hear all about it there. I can tell you it is incredibly exciting. It is a true page turner. It is very thrilling. It's exhilarating. A real cat and mouse affair with twists. You won't be able to put it down. So let's get to it, talking about his book, Hunting Time. This is Jeffrey Deaver.
Have haven't been skiing that long, I'm going to have to do something to get in shape, I tell you.
You got it. That's right. If you're going to be hitting the slopes of Vail, you need to be ready to go, Jeff. Get in shape. Yeah. You know,
back years, it was the black and the blue. Now I would be black and blue if I skied on those. So.
That's true, yeah. I can't go on a black. I can't do it. My friend tried to get me on a black once, and I just ended up on my hands and knees crawling down that.
If they're wide, well, if they were, I don't do that anymore. Right. Yeah, I'm 72 years old. I'm not crazy. But if they're wide, that's fine. I don't mind steep. Mm-hmm. It's wide, but the chutes I don't do. That's just crazy.
So. Right. Yeah. That's nuts. Yeah. Well, then you got the bumps. I don't know. What do they call those? The
moguls.
The moguls. Way. Yeah. 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 That's what killed me. I said, you and
oh, yeah. Yeah. That'll blow your knees out for good, you know?
Now, if I recall from one time, and it's great to talk to you again, by the way, Jeff, thanks so much for joining us. Yeah. I loved the new book so much. The best one yet. I don't know how you do it. But anyway, let's talk about your new book, the latest installment in the Coulter Shaw series, the best one yet, in my mind. This is a tale of bottled water, selfies, and cannibalistic butterflies. Jeffrey Deaver, what was it that inspired you to write this latest chapter?
Dave, I got to use that as a cover quote.
There you go. You're welcome.
That is
You're
so
welcome.
Good. Well, the Coulter Shaw, I'll say very briefly who Coulter Shaw is. Coulter Shaw is my second main hero, Lincoln Rhyme being the first. Lincoln Rhyme is sort of a Sherlock Holmes, modern day, but you know him from The Bone Collector. I'm sure your listeners
right.
do, too.
Absolutely.
Coulter Shaw is the opposite of that. He travels around the country. He's the classic from the old westerns, like The Man with No Name, the Sergio Leone films, Clint Eastwood, Shane from the old movie in the 60s. And we love that template of a character. He's the knight from old times. Now, these books are set in the modern day, of course, but he travels around the country in a Winnebago looking for rewards that have been offered by maybe parents for a missing child, kids for a missing parent. Police who can't find a particularly bad bank robber or serial killer, escaped prisoners. And that's how he makes his living. And Coulter is very interesting. He doesn't really care about the money. There could be $1 million reward. And he says, I don't care. What he cares about is the fact that there is a reward. And if there's a reward, that means that there's a problem that the police cannot solve. And he likes the challenge. His nickname he got from his father is the Restless One. And he's very restless. And so he travels around in the Winnebago and looks for things. This book is set in the, very briefly, set in the Rust Belt in America and a town that's very depressed. Think Flint, Michigan, sort of pollution problems.
For sure.
But there's a savior industrialist who comes to town and is going to rejuvenate the whole place by building a miniature reactor company. Now, these things are real.
Yeah, I wouldn't ask you about that. Those are real. Yeah. I had to Google it.
You can buy one if you want. They're very small. They fit in your backyard. Well, actually, you can't buy one, but they're going to turn around. You know, it's the days of green energy now, and some people say nuclear is a problem, but the fact is, it's I think it's less of a problem than fossil fuel.
Yeah,
so
right.
There we've got the manufacturer, but a part goes missing. Coulter is looking for the part, but the main story is that the designer of this part, a woman engineer, brilliant woman, is suddenly pursued by a psychotic ex-husband, by two very nefarious bad guys, by other individuals I won't mention because I don't want to give anything away.
Right.
And then Coulter has to go out in the wilderness to find her and her teenage daughter. And so Shaw finds himself up against all these bad guys and, of course, a 16-year-old with an attitude. And so he's got the
big time.
You know, I don't know which is worse, you know, hit men or teenagers.
Right.
So,
like, yeah.
So anyway, that's basically the story. It's typical Deaver. It takes place over a day and a half. Lots of internal reversals, three big surprise endings that I labor really hard to make sure they work.
Yeah, I can still see the sweat stains on the brow of your forehead from all the work you had to have
done. Well, actually, you should see like the claw marks on my wall or less sweat than banging my head against the sheetrock.
We have a 16-year-old daughter
What do you do when you're stuck up against a problem in the plot and you're really stuck? Like, what is your go-to? Do you have to go outside, go for a walk, walk it off? Do you call someone? Like, what do you do?
Walking is quite interesting. And curiously, I'm teaching a course later today for the International Thriller Writers. It's on pacing. And I teach writing and pacing. One of the things I say, and this is about how fast the book goes, how to speed it up, slow it down. Mm-hmm. But at the very end, I say pacing. Interesting you mentioned that, because when I'm having trouble coming up with a plot idea, I pace. And it's kind of a double entendre, a play on words. But it is true. That kind of burns off some energy. And I don't know. I just think better. And you know, I mentioned Colter Shaw is the restless one. I'm restless too. I have to move. I have to think. And when I do that, then the ideas suddenly materialize, or they don't. And if they don't, that means it's either a book I should not be working on, or that's a plot direction that's not going to go. And I should say, I outline all my books ahead of time.
Right.
I don't pace when I'm writing the book, because I know where it's going to go. Hunting Time ended up being about 150-page outline. 8 months to do. I knew where everything was going to go. And then once that was done, I could sit down and I wrote the book in about, a month and a half. That was very easy.
Have you always worked that way with outlines?
No. And that's a very good question. I did not. And my first books were, they were not thrillers of the sort I write now. They were smaller. They were like murder mysteries. And a couple of them were nominated for awards, but they didn't sell really well. And I thought, you know what, let me analyze a couple of them. So I outlined them. I took the printed book and what happens chapter one, what happens chapter two, what happens and so forth. And I said, oh my God, how stupid could I be? I gave away the identity of a, not the main bad guy, but a bad guy here. It was easy for a reader to figure out. I digressed. I did a whole chapter on the building of the Statue of Liberty. They were set in New York, modern day books, but I thought I was interested in the Statue of Liberty. It had nothing to do with the story. And so I said, you know what? Outlining them now, well, that was stupid. I mean, I had to do it.
Yeah, you had to do it.
Problems. But now in the future, I'll outline first, which I did. And that was my book, Praying for Sleep, my first big book. That goes back about 30 books ago. I've written about 45 novels. That goes back 33 books or so. And ever since then, I've been outlining. And it's the only way to go.
Wow. That's so interesting. Yeah. I don't know how the pantsers do it. I don't know how they do it. So this is
Let me just say that I'm glad you brought that up, because the writing world is divided into two camps: the plotters, like myself, outliners, and pantsers, as in seat of the pants, which is a very, very clever phrase. I don't know how they do it. You know, it's you may write 200 words, beautiful prose. And then you come to a block and you don't know where you're going to go. And then you maybe get an idea. You have to go back and rewrite 200 words. Well, do the outline. And what do you do? Throw out a couple post-it notes that you've got stuck to your wall and fix that. It's just so much more efficient.
When you go to like a writing conference, do like all the pantsers hang out in one corner of the room and the outliners in the other? Or
yeah, we want to play dodgeball. I've been trying to organize that, but nobody's up for it.
You got to get that going.
Oh, I'd pay to see that. That would be so good. That's really funny.
Well, you know, and we're writers. We're all nerds. You know, we throw it to go backwards.
That's true.
I'd hit myself and bounce off again.
It would bounce off something.
Eliminate myself. Yeah, exactly.
That's really funny. This is such an exciting thriller, though. And it's also, very much a book about family, about mothers and daughters, fathers and daughters. Was that an area that you were interested in exploring when you set out to write this book?
No, it wasn't. I really had the idea that this book was going to be about Colter Shaw saving these people, but I didn't know who the people were going to be. But then I gave her a daughter, and then that said, oh, now he has to have a connection with this girl because he doesn't have any children in his life. And so that's what he's, that was a perfect way to bring in an extra subplot that had a lot of emotion to it.
It did. It really brought a lot of humanity to it. And I loved that part of the book. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I can't believe he's never heard of MacGyver. She had to tell him who.
Well, that's the way it sorry, I just got a text.
You're good.
No, good. Thank you. This is satellite radio day and people, do schedule changes and things like
that. Gotcha. Yeah.
Well, you know, Coulter is a guy who had a quite interesting upbringing. His father and mother were both brilliant scientists and professors at, I don't name Cal, but it's University of California in Berkeley. And they had to flee because of something his father found. And those are explored, those topics are explored in the first three books, The Never Game, The Goodbye Man, and Final Twist, the first three Coulter Shaw books. And the plot involved Coulter Shaw's father having to take the whole family to the Sierra Nevada, a compound, and teach them survival skills. And we don't know why at first, but in the final twist, that's revealed, the terrible things that he's discovered. And so Coulter is a survivalist. And what a, you know, an odd thing that could be. We think survivalists are wackos, you know, anti-government. Yeah. They think the aliens are going to come down from Earth. And, you know, planet Xantar actually sends lasers down to affect our voting machines. And there are a lot of those, certainly. A lot of
plenty of those. Too many.
But too many, absolutely. But there are also some people who just want to be self-reliant. Yeah. And one of his father's most valued possessions is a copy, a first edition copy of Self-Reliance by Ralph Waldo Emerson that teaches us to be self-reliant. And when we can rely on ourselves, then we can help other people, basically. And Coulter Shaw came out of that, and he learns survival skills. Frankly, I hadn't thought about it, but that may be one of the reasons that he does this, that he sees people in extremis, you know, they're missing, they're in danger, and he risks his own life to go save them.
Interesting.
Have you done any survival course training or thought about doing it? Does that gene in you a little bit at all?
No. People ask me, are you? Sorry. No. I don't mean to laugh, but yeah, none of that. But I'll tell you this. I make up a lot of stuff. You know, that's what we do. I was a lawyer a long time ago, and I made up stuff for a living then. I do it now, but it's much more legitimate when I write fiction. Yeah, I'm making up stuff. Yeah. But I do a lot of research, you know, internet research and in-person research. But I thought, you know, okay, I ought to check out a little bit about Coulter Shaw. And I do shoot. I collect guns. I don't hunt, despite the title Hunting Time. But although I will say I did sadly end up with some venison. And it cost me $12,000. My hunting weapon was a 2-year-old Chevy Traverse. And it was sad both for the deer and for me. Anyway, but it was the only hunting I've ever done. I wouldn't recommend it.
No.
But I do know guns, so I know a little. I can speak in an informed way about that. But I thought, well, Coulter Shaw he climbs rocks. I ought to know a little bit about that.
Sure.
And so I didn't want to go to a rock climbing place because, you know, these walls they have at REI and things like that.
Yeah.
Because next to me, there would be like a 7-year-old boy who would race to the top.
No, there would.
And I'm going like this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but so what I did was I went to Amazon and I bought a set of rappelling gear. You know what rappelling is? You know, you hook the ropes up and you have this kind of metal thing to lower yourself. Slowly the rope goes through it. And I thought, well, I'm going to try it. My back porch is 7 feet above the ground. And I hooked it all up. And I turned around, you know, you turn around and face the rock. I face my porch and I leaned back and I said, no way in hell. And I leaned forward, climbed up. So if you or any of your listeners want a set of rappelling gear unused, it's available. Laura, long answer to a short question. No, there's none of me in there. But but the research is accurate. It is all accurate. And the survival techniques one could actually use. I mean, if you want to know how to, if you're in an avalanche, there's a scene. I don't think it's in Hunting Time, although it could be. The books kind of run together for me. But so you're in an avalanche. You're trapped in the snow. How do you dig out? Well, you kind of make a little space for your so you can breathe. And there's some air that comes through the snow. Can't last forever. No. You wad up a snowball, hold it up, and drop it, and it will fall in the opposite direction of what's up.
Right.
So that's how you know where up is. And you're in Colorado, so that may come in handy. I hope it never does. But the stuff I learned for Coulter was, you know, actually quite intriguing and useful.
That's interesting. You also have a lot of math in this book.
yeah, that's not me now, either.
Let me ask you about that too.
Yeah.
Were you good at math at school?
No. I took a course to graduate from I went to University of Missouri Journalism School.
Oh, wow.
I started there in 68, graduated in 72. And that was a different era. We had, it still may be true, I don't know, I haven't been in a college for a long time, but we had to pass a swim test. And wow. It's Missouri, for God's sakes. You know, what are we going to do? It's not like Delray Oaks or anything like that.
That's weird.
The Missouri River was probably 30 miles away, but we had to pass a swim test. And we also had to take, requirements. You had to take math, the language, and so forth. Well, the only math course I dared take was, Missouri has a great journalism school, so a lot of writers come there. I had to take a course in math, and the one I chose, the only one I could get through, was called Math for Writers.
Wow, really? You're kidding me.
And it was an algebra. It was a basic algebra course. And algebra, I'm sure you took algebra freshman in high school.
Right, yeah.
And then calculus, trigonometry, and maybe, more advanced stuff. Oh, no way. I just couldn't get through. So, but I had friends who were, and there's, you don't need calculus to get through this book. I simply wanted to show that the daughter, the 16-year-old daughter of Hannah is her name, is a almost a prodigy when it comes to math. And she's doing her nails. She's texting her boyfriend. She's doing what 16-year-olds do.
Yeah.
And she glances down at these. She's in AP calculus. And she glances down at the thing. And her mother says, "Your answers are not, they're not done. Your homework's due tomorrow." And she's doing her nails, and she says, "Yeah." And I'm not going to give the formula because I don't remember what it was. But AZ over 7 times 5 in parentheses. Well, yeah. And her mother says, "Oh, that's right. How did you get it?" And she says, "You have to show your work." And she says, she points to her head and says, "That's how I did it."
Yeah.
And so, but I wanted to give that to show who she was, both attitudinal and a genius.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that came about. In that way, but there's not too much math. It's just kind of illustrative in the story. Mostly, it's just exciting.
Yeah, it is.
That's for sure. Now, listen, you've got this character in this book in Merritt. Now, Merritt is a former cop, now a convict on the run, going after his ex-wife. So he's in a hurry, but he doesn't want to get pulled over by the cops. So he travels at what he deems to be a safe speed, which is 6 miles an hour over the speed limit. I like to bump it up to 9, personally.
You can go 9.
What do you do?
And I do. I'm probably 7. The difference. Okay. And by the way, if an insurance company were to call you just out of the blue, I was doing 70 miles an hour when I hit the deer, not 77.
Right. Okay. Of course. Yeah.
Because that's what the limit was.
Yeah.
Can't you guys out there do 80 or 90? Don't in Colorado? Don't they
have 75?
75 is
that means people do 85 and 90, basically.
Yeah. Well, I heard, actually, I had a friend who was a state patrol guy, and he said, there's the speed limit, and then there's the imaginary speed limit,
right.
And we all know they don't pull you over if you're not.
Well, especially if you're on the freeway, and when I say I go 9, I'm talking a freeway, a wide open freeway, like. Yeah.
So when you hit the deer, did the deer like bump and go over the hood, or did you end up in the ditch? How did that work?
I don't know. Doing wink, wink, 70 miles an hour.
70 mile an hour.
That deer just disappeared. I mean, it went.
Wow.
I mean, I felt bad, but because it was, and I was driving along, and it was just there. No warning whatsoever.
No, they both.
Bang.
Yeah.
It took half my front end off. But I'll tell you what the interesting thing. I grew up in the Midwest in the 60s and 70s when we still had snow in the Midwest. I mean, of course, it still gets cold, but it wasn't like it was then. And I learned to drive on snow and ice. And it's just ingrained in me as you did. And so the problem was not the deer. The problem was that when I hit the deer to the left, on the left side of the car, what did that do? Started a really bad skid. The rear end went to the right. Well, I knew what to do. Of course, foot off the brake, foot off the gas, didn't touch it.
Right.
Just skeered into the rear end, going both ways, and finally controlled it. And so I was without braking, I was, and ABS doesn't work in skids. It has nothing to do with that. ABS prevents skidding when you're braking, but not when you hit a stupid deer, suicidal deer. And so I was probably 100 yards down the road, so I don't know where little Bambi ended up, but it was long gone. So, and you know, I felt, I again felt bad, but you know, it wasn't my job. I didn't drive into the field to get
it made the
can I outrun that Chevy Traverse? Oh, you know what? I think it's only doing 70 miles an hour. I bet I can make it.
So. If only you'd have been doing. No, yeah, I've hit a deer before too. Luckily, it just glanced off, but I my car ended up in the ditch, and the deer ran away, laughing at me. But they bolt. You don't see them coming. It's impossible, especially at dusk when they seem to be everywhere. But Coulter's back at it again. He's got his fancy fountain pen once again, the black with the three orange rings toward the nib. Have you ever tried to write with a fountain pen?
I have. I'm not an aficionado of them, but I'll tell you where that came about. And I should mention that to your listeners that Coulter Shaw, being a survivalist, has many sides to his personality. He has incredible handwriting. He writes very small, absolutely precise. Mm-hmm. He learned that from his father, probably genetic, but you know, maybe some skill he learned too. And when he takes on one of his reward cases, he is extremely methodical about it. He has notebooks that detail every aspect of the missing person. He sits down and writes page after page of details about this individual. Then he thinks about how to best find them. And, you know, a lot of psychological drama in that, but also he's very left-brained. You know, he's a cowboy. He shoots them up when he has to shoot them up. That's true. But I like the idea of his analyzing every situation, and this is something that is within me, according to percentages. And for instance, he will see a bad guy following him, and he knows this is a hired hitman. And Coulter Shaw thinks, okay, I have a 92%. He's not that fastidious. Let's say I've got a 90% chance of wrestling him to the ground if he comes after me. There is probably, because we're in town now, say downtown Denver, probably, well, I'll make it a different state. I don't know what your concealed carry permits are like, but let's say where I am, Raleigh, North Carolina. It's easy. I had to take a course for mine, but let's say he's in Raleigh and he says, okay, the odds are here he doesn't, it's a misdemeanor, serious misdemeanor charge to have a concealed weapon without a permit. He probably doesn't have a permit. So I could take him physically. But on the other hand, there is a 97% chance the police are going to find out about it, and that would blow my cover. So the best thing to do is just leave and get out of his way and hide from him. And you think a hero hiding? Well, that's what Coulter Shaw does if it's the most efficient thing to do. And, I mean, I personally would be like 100% hide kind of person. But, you know,
he plays the odds. He plays the odds.
Yeah, exactly. He does. Yeah, and people have loved that, and they also love the never rules. His father handed down a number of rules. None of them come to mind right now. I guess never be without a means of escape. Never be without access to a weapon. Hundreds of others that you know, readers kind of love. Oh, and before I forget it, I should mention that these are called the never rules. He and his brother just refer to them that way. But the never game, the first Coulter Shaw book, is going to be a CBS series.
Yes. Congratulations. That's so exciting.
Thank you so much. Starring Justin Hartley from This Is Us, directed by Ken Olin. Yeah. It was from 30-something also involved in This Is Us and other shows. A great great bunch of people. It's being shot right now. It may very well have been shot. I'm not sure. It's about a murder in Silicon Valley and an individual who becomes so obsessed with video games, it seems, that he takes an action-adventure game into real life and has his victims, kidnaps his victims, and basically makes them escape from a Mario scenario or a Doom scenario. and cool. But you know, Assassin's Creed kind of thing.
Oh, interesting.
Although there's much more to it than that, because nothing in one of my books is what it seems to be.
No,
but anyway, I think it's going to be a fun book. So we know the TV show Silicon Valley. I just don't know of a serious crime series that's been set there within the, you know, the hallowed halls of, I mentioned Apple, but Apple isn't involved in the crime, of course, but you know, Sun Computer, it's such a fascinating place. I wrote a book a few years ago called The Blue Nowhere, which was about murder in Silicon Valley. And that was kind of the height, or I shouldn't say the height, but it was the beginning of the huge trend toward digitization and the start of the computer era. And there was so much history there. And we think about, you know, history as being Michelangelo art and architecture. Well, you know, the computer world has a history too, and it's just as romantic and just as interesting. Mm-hmm. And so I've been fascinated with it for years. And technology always figures in my books in some way.
Yeah.
And it's very much in the forefront of the Never Game. So I know they'll do a good job with the TV show. I wanted to be a dead body in it.
Yeah.
I think that's the only thing I could do, but I think they've already cast the victim. Maybe next time.
Next time.
Yeah, you need a cameo. I would flip out. That'd be so exciting. Yeah, congratulations on getting that. That's really exciting.
That's awesome.
Thank you. Very fun.
We're looking forward to that, and we've just loved Hunting Time. Such a great thriller. What a great read. Can't get enough of Coulter Shaw, and it sounds like we're going to get more of them next year in various formats. So.
Indeed. Well, and we'll also have a Lincoln Rhyme coming up. Ooh. And then I should say quickly, I write stories for Amazon Original Stories. Oh. And I've got a 4-story cycle coming out later in the year called The Broken Doll. Okay. And that's quite exciting. I think your listeners will enjoy that.
Jeff, that sounds great.
Take a break. Take a break, for goodness sakes. You're still working too hard. What are you doing?
I did last Sunday. Sorry. And my team lost, so what was the fun of that? So, okay. All right. Take care of both of you. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you. Always great to chat with you. Thanks so much.
Bye.
So long.
Bye-bye.
See you next year.
Sounds great. Bye-bye. The Inside Flop. All right, there you go. Thank you to the great Jeffrey Deaver for joining us. Check out his book, Hunting Time. Now let's open it up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some
book reviews.
Well, let's start with
Laura Medicus.
Where we are, I don't know where we are.
Laura, what do you got for us this week?
I have a book called Keeper of Enchanted Rooms.
What a great title.
By Charlie N. Holmberg. So this book was right up my magic-loving alley's fantasy book. I absolutely loved it. It's set in the mid-1800s in America, and there's a novelist named Merritt, and he gets a letter in the mail. Hey, you've inherited a home from a distant relative. And it's on a very remote piece of land off of Narragansett Bay, which I think is near Rhode Island. I love this trope. In books.
Yeah.
I love the letter from a relative you didn't know you had.
Well, yeah, because you get to put yourself in that position.
I love it. It's one of my favorite things.
So it all sounds good unless you're Chevy Chase.
Oh, did he do that?
Yeah, there's a movie and I forget what it's called.
Oh, really?
But he inherits a house or something like that and he's got to go and it's a disaster.
I will
Funny Farm, maybe? Or is it Tom Hanks, The Burbs?
No, I forget what the name of the book is. I will look it up.
They, in all of these, though, whenever you get that house, there will be something wrong with it, just like you said. Yeah, there will be.
Got to be something wrong.
I love that trope. So right away, I'm like, oh, this is good. You okay, Andrew?
He's up, he's turning around, he's Nelson just spinning around before he sits down on the couch.
So Merritt's living in a rented apartment in Baltimore at the time, and he thinks, why not Baltimore, no less.
How
Baltimore, yeah. And, you know, if you've ever been to Baltimore and lived in a rented apartment in Baltimore, you're like, yeah, I'll take that. I'll take a ticket out.
yeah, for sure.
I'll take a ticket out.
Yes, I do have a sound effect of that guy running away from Baltimore. Where is it? I guess I don't have a sound effect.
Okay.
Okay, never mind.
So he thinks, I'm handy. I'm going to go. I'm going to fix this place up. There you go.
There he is.
I'm going to write my novel, and I'll live there rent-free. He's excited to see the place. He has all kinds of ideas about what it might look like. And when he gets there, you know, it's only accessible via boat. It's basically on an island. And he finds a beautiful piece of land that seems untouched. You know, there's like wild turkeys running around. There's birds. There's interesting plants and beautiful trees. Like, it's stunning. And the house also, at least on the outside, also looks very well maintained and also untouched. So he goes inside, and besides being dusty, there appears to be nothing wrong with it, and also no signs that anyone is living there either. However, strange things start to happen almost right away. Some of the furniture looks like it's melting. It rains.
Melting?
It rains paint on him in an upstairs hallway.
Wait a second.
There's some strange things that start to happen. He tries to leave the home, and the house physically will not let him leave. So Merritt is trapped inside this house. Wow. The house will not let him leave. So cut to a woman named Hulda, who works for something called BIKER. The acronym is BIKER, which is the Boston Institute for the Keeping of Enchanted Rooms. Okay. So this is where that's the magic, cool. There's magic in this world. Right. And this is when you're like, oh, there's magic here. So she gets sent to this poor Merritt's house. It's called the Wimbrel House, by the way, to help him learn how to work with the magic that the house contains. Would have been nice for Merritt to have known that this was a magic house that he was inheriting, but he did not. No one told him that. So this BIKER Institute, they keep track of this type of property. And whenever it changes hands, they send someone in to assist the new owner. So Hulda arrives. She does manage to help Merritt get out of the house. I think he's in a hole when she discovers him. Then the house is refusing to let him go. And she ends up staying a while to try to help. She's like kind of struggling with figuring out what type of magic the building has. Like, where's the source of the magic coming from? And also, Merritt's like not really sure that he likes owning a magic house. So he's kind of think, maybe I don't want to keep this house. And the house basically plays games with everyone in it.
Oh, wow.
So
cool.
This book's really likable. Merritt and Hulda are very likable main characters. It's also, there's a lot of humor in here. It's very funny. Merritt ends up hiring a cook. There's a lot of funny stuff with this cook. He has a housekeeper that he adds to the mix. So you've got four people living here. And it just starts to get funny.
Oh, this book sounds like a lot of fun.
So there's some evil lurking around as well, which adds some drama to the story.
Well, you got to have lurking evil.
And it doesn't sound like the house is particularly evil.
It's not.
Yeah.
It's like a merry prankster.
Yes. And there's a great secret that comes out about the house, which I loved. I absolutely loved it. Not going to tell you.
Tell me off air.
So what's not to love about a magic house? Like, it's the best. Great. So this is book one. It just came out in November. It's free on Kindle Unlimited. And book two looks like it'll be out sometime next year.
All right.
And it's called, The Wimbrel House 1, but it's called Keeper of Enchanted Rooms.
That one, that really sounds like a lot of fun.
It's delightful.
I'd like to check that one out. Mm-hmm. All right. That's recommended by
Laura Medicus.
And I will tell you that there's a real magic house in St. Louis.
Oh, really?
But it's called the Magic House.
Oh.
And it basically is, it's a house for kids to go in. I wouldn't say it's a science center, but it actually started as like a house that they made it as like a playhouse, or like a really exceptional playhouse for kids. And it just got bigger and bigger. But it's in Kirkwood, Missouri. And that is indeed called the Magic House.
Wow.
But it's pretty spectacular.
That's
place.
That's neat, yeah. Andrew. I'll look
All
that
right.
up.
Very cool. All right, my book this week.
Dave Medicus. This is why we can't have nice things.
Is by a friend of the show and frequent guest, Peter Swanson. And the name of the book is The Kind Worth Killing. Now, I'm a big fan of Peter Swanson. We've been lucky enough to talk to him several times on the show. Another nice guy. And I decided to dip back into his catalog, and I found this gem from 2015. This is an ingenious reimagining of the classic Patricia Highsmith novel, Strangers on a Train. I cannot rave about this book enough. This is twisty, dark, noirish fare that is a true page-turner with multiple narrators, multiple murders. You won't know who to trust, who to root for. This is just a stunner of a book, and one I could not put down. Now, listen, so many books nowadays, they'll just throw in twists just for the sake of having a twist in there. But when it is done right, The proper twist.
The twist.
Thank you, Jack Black. Boy, that's really quiet, isn't it? The proper twist. The proper twist.
The twist.
Okay, there you go. When it's done right, it doesn't just surprise you. It makes you want to just throw the book across the room in delight and start doing mule kicks across the living room carpet. The correctly done twist is one that should inspire joy and delight in the reader, and that's what Swanson does here several times. Now, I'll give you a brief snapshot of the novel without giving too much away. Two strangers meet up on a plane from London to Boston, Ted and Lily, and they decide to play a little game. It's the Let's Be Honest game. Well, in the playing of this game, Ted reveals that his wife, Miranda, has been cheating on him. And if he's being honest, well, he wouldn't mind if she ended up dead. And naturally, Lily, well, turns out she would be all too happy to help. So they get back to Boston and start planning out Miranda's, Ted's wife's, murder. And meanwhile, we learn a few things about Lily thanks to several dark and devious flashbacks. Let's just say she is no one you want to mess with. To say anything more about this book would be a crime. If you like your thrillers dark and unpredictable, you can't go wrong with this one. And a bonus for you, the sequel, The Kind Worth Saving, will be out this spring, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk to Peter about that one. This one is deliciously insidious. You will, your head will spin, your conscience will ask you what the hell you're doing reading a book like this. Listen, just go out there and check this one out. Highly recommended, The Kind Worth Killing by Peter Swanson, and that is recommended by
Dave Medicus.
All right, Andrew.
Don't stop, make it pop, DJ, blow my speakers up tonight.
What do you got for us this week?
So I'm reviewing a book by Ken Pence this week.
Another one.
Oh, another Ken Pence.
And I was going to see. And so it's a different book. It's a different series.
Okay.
All right.
I was actually going to pull your leg to see if you could believe I was reviewing the same book as last week, but no.
Oh.
Same author. And so
I don't think you'd do that.
This book is called Manual Interpretation. It is the Trade World Saga Book 1.
All right.
And so this is what I have coined the term the bootstrap genre.
Oh, yeah. You love those.
And the bootstrap genre is that, you know, you've got technology, but you're basically bootstrapping it where you basically have got to, like, you know, elevate technology real fast because there's some threat or there's something that's going on. And so...
Is it what Elon Musk thinks he's doing to Twitter?
You know,
no doubt.
I just don't know that I can use the adjectives on this show for what I think of Elon Musk.
Ooh, it's a family show, everybody. You family know. Show.
I hear you, Andrew.
So, and I don't want to risk us losing our Twitter account.
No, that's right.
That's right.
He's going to come right after us.
So, in any case, let's see. Let me get some decent thoughts back on track here. So, this book is, there's an alien. His name is Rhett. And he, you know, R-E-T-T. And Rhett basically, he is from some far-off civilization. He basically has developed like a little spaceship on his own. And he is from a universe or a galaxy that where, you know, having a spaceship and things like that is not a big deal. And faster than light travel is possible and everything. But what Rhett has done different and what is a little reckless is Rhett has built a spaceship where he is the only person on the ship, and he decides to just go out and explore, like, you know, places in the galaxy by himself.
Okay.
Right? So the alien, or the, I should say, the cast member that Rhett most resembles is Dave Medicus.
What?
No. Let me get to that.
What?
Accident prone.
Maybe. And so.
Forgetful.
So Rhett has a piece of technology that is a force field belt. And this force field belt can basically change gravity. And so while Rhett is out exploring Earth, out in Arizona or something, I believe, he actually breaks the belt. And so he's stuck inside this force field. But the force field is such that he has no ability to actually stand up because the friction coefficient is so low that he is just like, it's kind of like a turtle.
I think that's the first time the word coefficient has been used on the show, by the way.
And,
you know,
might not be the last, though.
Yeah. And so he can't move. And so Rhett is like, basically, I'm going to die on this miserable backwater planet, right? Because he simply, this force field is preventing him from interacting with his environment.
Just like when you go out for a hike somewhere, you always want to tell someone when you go into a different planet, a different universe, you got to let people know what universe you're going to.
Mm-hmm. So now, the main human character of this book, his name is Andrew. Brilliant guy, by the way. Okay. I mean, we're talking brilliant. Yeah. So he's
is he good looking as well?
Probably is. Yeah. Andrew. So he's out for a run.
That's where all the similarities.
Yeah. This Andrew. Yeah. So anyways, so Andrew is a PhD candidate, and he's leading a team, and in this, you know, this near Earth future, it has happened like post pandemic. Like there's a pandemic where like 30% of the world's population has been killed off, and things have changed. And so a degree, a PhD, isn't just about one candidate. It's about a team of people working together. And so Andrew's leading the team, and he's not quite sure what their project should be, because their project is make or break. If it's a good project, like they all get degrees and jobs. If it's not a good project, then they all fail. I mean, you sink or swim together as a team. You know, and it's just, I guess it's one of the things I love about science fiction is it explores different things like that, different socioeconomic, you know, situations, and you get to kind of test those things. So he's out for a run, and sure enough, he sees this strange creature on the ground, and he realizes the person needs help. And so, of course, he kind of realizes, well, this person's in a force field or something, and he has no ability to interact with his environment. He's like, but how do I cancel the force field? Hmm. Right? And so he, you know, I guess he has a pocket knife or something. He tries that, and the next thing you know, the pocket knife gets, like, you know, blown to smithereens because the force field is so strong. And so he realizes he needs a fluid that will pass through the force field and short-circuit it. So he basically dumps water out of his canteen onto it, but the water won't short-circuit it because there's obviously no mineral content, right, to actually short-circuit the belt. And so what does he use?
Battery acid.
Pee.
He pees in his canteen. Oh,
that was my second guess.
And he dumps pee on the alien, and sure enough, there's enough electrolytes in there.
There you go.
That it short-circuits the force field. So if you see a trapped alien, you know, just you know.
Drink some water.
Yeah.
Get busy.
Yeah, get busy. So, you know, that's kind of the comical presence there. And so the alien has absolutely complete contempt for humanity. I mean, he thinks we're, you know, Cro-Magnon man. Like he has, and even like throughout this book, and I've read like three books in the series, but Rhett never really develops any. Well, maybe towards the third book, he starts to develop a little bit of respect for humans. But he has like complete contempt. And so, what does he do for Andrew, who now has been knocked unconscious? What does he do? Because Andrew has just saved his life. He kidnaps him, and he takes him on board his spaceship so he can dissect him.
Just like what aliens we think aliens want to do to us.
And see what
how
makes
to cook man.
And see what makes him tick. So of course Andrew ends up turning the tables on him.
Sorry, that's how to serve man.
Yeah, how to serve man.
Right.
Great.
Cookbook.
Twilight Zone. Yeah. Do. We need some Twilight Zone music. So the it's just not the same as the original Twilight Zone. So anyways, he turns the table, he escapes, and he basically takes with him the broken belt, and he also takes a few other little baubles as he escapes the spaceship. Now Rhett gets the hell out of there because he shouldn't have been on the planet in the first place. And Rhett actually gets captured by the exploration services, and they are asking him, what the hell are you doing here? You shouldn't be, this is a forbidden sector, you shouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm.
And Rhett's like, well, you know, I was just checking things out. And, you know, so Rhett ends up getting taken into custody. And they're like, well, did you do any technology contamination in the society? And Rhett's like, oh, no, I didn't. Mm. I didn't contaminate technology. So now Andrew and his team have got some great new PhD topics to research. And so what they discover from the belt is powered by cold fusion. So the team now has a unlimited source of cheap, clean energy. They also have the force field technology. And they also figure some other things out from this technology, like time dilation. You know, and the time dilation is cool is because what ends up happening is they realize now that we're under threat from aliens, right? So, you know, you got to create the scenario where all of a sudden time is of the essence. And so what do you do if, you know, you only have a limited amount of time and you got to prepare for all these aliens that are going to come to your planet? So you create a time dilation field where time moves 30 times faster in the dilation field. So when an hour passes outside, 30 hours passes inside, and you can get 30 times as much work done, right, in that one amount of time. 1 year would equal 30 years inside the field. So you could get 30 years worth of work done in a single year. And so, you know, this is like, I call it a, you know, a bootstrap genre, but there are power struggles. There are, you know, alien antics, you know, and the aliens aren't all bad guys. They're not all good guys. I would say that
Or gals.
I would say they're very human. in that, just the odd humor. And part of it is because it's the Trade World Saga. The premise of the book is, like, this whole universe works on trade, and we have to get ready to trade on decent footing with the aliens. And one of the things that's really cool about the book is when the first aliens come to trade, you know, everybody's trying to get one over on the other one, and just kind of learning about, you know, different things. So the one aliens that come up, they have certain smells, you know, like cinnamon, you know, and other smells. But, you know, the smells aren't necessarily what we would interpret as basically good or bad. But that's one of the other things, like, that's really fun about the book is when they get into the negotiations and stuff like that, and just the different perspectives. And, you know, as you go through life, you just realize people have different perspectives, right? And sometimes you realize, like, what the hell is that person thinking, right? I mean, we all, you know, and the answer's don't really know. We just realize that person isn't thinking the same thing as me. But, you know, this book has a good bit of that. So it really is a very enjoyable book. It is a great, it's really a great fun. I would say there are some laugh out loud moments in the book, but the book is called Manual Interpretation, Trade World Saga, Book One.
All right, cool. And that's recommended by
Andrew Dowd.
Which brings us to the audiobook of the week. And in keeping with my theme this week of dark and twisted works with potentially unsympathetic heroes, I bring you How to Kill Your Family by Bella Mackey, narrated by Charlie Clive and Paul Panting. Now, if you're like me and you like the new, or if you're like Laura and you love the new Taylor Swift song Anti-Hero, then you will love this book, a tale of a woman who is a true anti-hero as she is systematically setting out to murder everyone in her family. And by her family, I mean to say her rich father's family, who was never there for her, and who was never there for her mother, even when her mother was dying and reaching out for help. Well, she finds out about this millionaire father, and she vows her revenge on him and his family and sets about taking them down. So we find out from the very beginning as she is in prison for, the irony is, she tells us she murdered six of the family members, but she's locked up for a murder she didn't commit. We just don't know which one that is. So she narrates the whole thing from prison. She has a very, this character is a very snarky, full of sarcastic wit, very funny. I found her very funny. And she tells her story in flashback form. And a lot of the fun in this one is reading about the manner in which she plans these murders. She's very creative. Grace is a snarky, sarcastic type, hell-bent on revenge. And I love the book's dark sense of humor. Now, don't go into this one looking for sympathetic characters or people to root for. This is a send-up of the world in which we live in now with our love of serial killers. See the recent success of Netflix's Dahmer. I love dark, twisted, demented books like this one, and if you're like me, you will too. It's quite enjoyable. Let's take a listen to a clip. This is How to Kill Your Family, And don't leave this one on the coffee table lying around, as I found out, as Laura said, what the hell are you doing reading
this? Yeah, multiple times I saw it around the home, and I'm like, I don't feel comfortable with this.
Hmm.
Yes. Well, again, it's not her family per se that she's going after. Anyway, let's take a listen to a clip. How to Kill Your Family by Bella Mackey.
I am confident that the merest hint that I might tell her some juicy nugget about my story will have her tapping her nose like a ludicrous character in a Dick Francis novel and leave me to it. Of course, my story is not for Kelly. I doubt she'd have the capacity to understand what motivated me to do as I did. My story is just that, mine. Though I know readers would lap it up if I ever published it, not that I ever could. But it's nice to know that people would pore over it nonetheless. It would be a bestseller, and the masses would rush to the shops, hoping to know more about the attractive and tragic young woman who could commit such a terrible act.
All right, there you go. That'll do it for us this week. Thanks so much for joining us. Episode 180. Thanks to Jeffrey Deaver for coming by. Check out his new book. It is called Hunting Time, his new Coulter Shaw book. In my estimation, the best of the Coulter Shaw series thus far. Really could not put this one down. I can't recommend it enough. So that'll do it. My name is Dave Medicus. See you next time.
Adios.
Excelsior.
We're all nerds.